Hello and welcome to episode 44 of the Corporate Real Estate Insider Podcast, back with another episode. Great to see you guys. So starting today, we're talking about another update on industrial real estate, the market, and also development. Probably one of the most notable pieces of news since our last episode is that the development of new construction industrial space in Southern California is about 50% lower than it was during the peak of COVID. So we talked a lot about how we've seen vacancy rates essentially double or triple depending on what part of Southern California you're in. This, of course, is a trend that we're seeing across the country in most major distribution and industrial markets in general. But we're now actually starting to see developers buffer supply. But what's really interesting is that when you look at where the development pipeline in terms of total square footages of what is going to deliver in the next couple of years in Southern California. And this is relatively similar in other markets around the country where we've really seen it come down. We're basically more or less at the level of development that we had in 2018 and 2019 now. And when I say like level of development, I mean the amount of buildings that are under construction right now, which most industrial buildings from the time they break ground to finish is about 12 months, depending on the size of the building. So these buildings are that inventory represents the total amount under construction. So it's come down by 50% over the last couple of years, but it's still equal to what it was in 2019. And my question for all of you is, do you think that that is enough of a reduction to really make a meaningful difference in the supply-demand imbalance that's starting to emerge?
So I'll go first. So just take a step back. We recently ran a survey for a client that needs 150 to 300,000 feet of industrial space in the Inland Empire. And the number of options, Class A industrial space options in a very defined 10-mile radius around their current site was over 20. You extend that out to 15-mile radius, it was close to 50 options. The supply-demand imbalance there, and it's the same thing here in Boston, where you would have, or New England, this whole corridor as you head west into upstate New York, where you'd have, you know, 3 to 5 quality options. Now you have 10 to 20. So I think the demand side has dropped off. The supply that has been delivering over the last 12 to 18 months has not been leased at the same rate that many developers expected, or at a rate to be able to absorb the inventory at a reasonable level. So availability has skyrocketed, and I think it's a natural reaction is to just turn off the spigot. You have to slow down deliveries and you have to slow down the development pipeline in order to catch up. I think that it's probably a little too late in the short term, is my opinion. So you're going to see rates continue to come down, and you're going to see a continued or elevated availability of space for probably the next, 4 to 6 quarters, 8 quarters?
Yeah, maybe even longer. I mean, keep in mind that if you look in Southern California specifically, and I would venture to guess that this statistic probably applies generally, I mean, not perfectly, but generally across most major industrial markets in the U.S., if you look at the industrial space that was either completed in 2023 or is under construction now, only about 40% of that space has actually been leased or accounted for. So 60% of that space is still available. So if you apply that same metric and say, hey, the inventory that delivers in 24 and 25, that only 40% of that new construction inventory is actually going to lease by, say, this time next year, you start looking at what that does. It means vacancy is just going to tick higher and higher, which I personally think is realistic. And what is likely to happen is that vacancy is just going to continue to go up, but it's going to be separated into kind of two tranches of space, right? It's not possible to deliver second generation buildings as new construction, right? So you're going to have a very high percentage of the total available market be represented by new construction buildings that are generally at very premium prices and are like true Class A, you know, maybe 36 to 40 foot clear, very nice buildings. But the portion of the market that isn't going to have much availability, that is still performing well and significantly better from a vacancy standpoint, is the second generation product that a lot more often, you see sort of more legacy type companies in, you see, generally see more manufacturers in those type of buildings, you know, people that have been in the same space for a long time. Similarly to what we've seen in office space where, you know, as Class A pricing, you know, goes up or remains constant and Class B pricing comes down, there's a spread that exists between these buildings. And, you know, John talks about this all the time is at a certain point, there is a price difference where someone will go, okay, I can't ignore how a Class B building is priced. The issue is in industrial real estate, unlike office space, the amount of Class B inventory that is actually available is extremely low because they're not making any more of it. And generally those rents are much lower. And at some point, if you're relocating, you probably can't even consider a second generation building because there's none available. And all of the available product is new construction. And that's only going to be exacerbated as this next wave of under construction buildings deliver.
Okay, but here's the thing. If you think about new development, I mean, builders build, that's what they do, right? And there's two reasons to develop new industrial product, I believe. One is to replace the aging obsolete inventory. There's a time where buildings just get too old and they get replaced by new buildings. The other reason to add new industrial inventory is in response to growth. So if we pick a measure for growth, let's say total, you know, you can look at total non-farm employment. And the from 2015 to 2020, it was a very consistent, steady uptick up and to the right of job growth. And then the pandemic hit. And of course, that crashes. And slowly coming out of the pandemic, it's built back up. And if you look at that chart, it's now back on that stabilized growth line of 2015 to 2020. And I would say that the building sounds like maybe it's returned to maybe an equilibrium delivery of additional new industrial real estate, both to replace the obsolete buildings coming off the market, but in response to this growth as represented by that non-farm employment growth.
Don't disagree with you, John. I think, Tucker, to your earlier statement, I think part of the problem with the marketplace right now is it just like the other sectors like office, it became a financial instrument to create value for investors rather than rely on the fundamentals. So, you know, I was just looking at for a client, some vacancy for this particular owner had four building portfolio. They were quietly shopping on the marketplace. Well, they bought it for $80 a foot. They were trying to sell it at one point for $450 a foot. And right now they'll accept $250, $300 a foot. So the rents that they want to be able to create that value are pushing into the new construction range, right? They want to compete with the lower end of new construction. And this building only has 32 foot clear. It's built 10 years ago. And it didn't trade. And the ownership can still make a profit on the exit at a lower number. So we'll see what happens, but there's a number of buildings and a lot of examples that did trade and traded multiple times in this cycle that have pushed the basis up, similar to office buildings that could be taking certain inventory out of the equation because they can't make deals at market rents to show the spread you're talking about. And it'll be interesting as the market continues to deteriorate, because I think it will. If that widening in terms of who can actually make a market deal and who can't, continues to, show itself.
So last little comment here is that when you look at what happened to the industrial real estate market in 2008, 2009, 10, kind of during the aftermath of the, you know, Great Recession, you actually saw development in Southern California fall to like a incredibly low level. I mean, at that point in time, we saw total Southern California new construction, you know, projects under development at that time fall to around 5 million square feet. I might be off by, you know, 1 million or 2 million square feet, but very low in the mid single digit millions that were under construction across all of Southern California. And you've really never seen industrial development get that sparse since. And you hadn't really seen industrial development be that sparse before. I mean, if you were to look at the last 20-year average under construction numbers in Southern California, and this is San Diego, Orange County, Los Angeles, and the Inland Empire, you know, most of the average and most periods of time, you'd be looking in the 30 to 40 million square foot range, excluding the last couple of years where you've really seen averages more in the, you know, high 40s to mid 50s, even pushing up in certain quarters closer to that 60 million square foot number. So I guess if, you know, if you're looking at a graph and the graph is, you know, pre-Great Recession here, and then it goes down and it's very low here in, you know, 2009 through 2010, 11, 12, and then it gets back up here and it's continuing out and then spikes. And now it's like we're into this unknown, like what happens next? Do you all think that we're actually going to get down to the level, the lack of development that we saw in 2009 and 10, where we go from kind of a baseline of right now we're in the, you know, mid 30s in terms of total 30 million square feet of total under construction products in Southern California? Do you think that we'll get back down to 5 or 10, and why?
I think the cycle that we're in right now proves that real estate is a cycle. It just was a longer growth cycle than it has been. And I think the overbuilding of this last, at least the last quarter of this cycle, is going to produce a requirement to have a significant pullback in new construction. So I think one, the lending environments are overly restrictive right now for developers. Two, demand has pulled back enough to be a concern for the long term, at least through where, if this is going to be a recession, you know, a mild recession, major recession, or soft landing, you know, hard landing. I think overall, because rental rates have spiked so high and cost of construction has spiked so high, that people are going to at least wait to see where that winds up. So you've got a lot of three or four different factors in my mind that create an environment where developers will wait on the sidelines, will look to buy distressed assets because, you know, I was just reading an article the other day. Goldman is going, and Goldman, on the investment side, is looking heavily at office and warehousing, right? So they're looking at those sectors as being opportunistic from the perspective of buying into those asset classes. So when you start to see folks looking at it from that perspective, where there's an opportunity, why would developers continue to build? They're going to let the market normalize. They're going to let the dust settle. And then you're going to start to see building again when they know they can have a higher likelihood of leasing, pre-leasing that building. So I think, yes, I think maybe not to the great financial crisis levels, because the market has obviously grown to higher levels since then. Like the bottom is a different bottom, but it's got a ways to go before it hits there.
And while we don't want to wade into politics, I think the outcome of the November election is going to be highly impactful, likely, I would say, disruptive and, you know, different in the short term from the long term. But like, I think there's going to be some shocks up or down. And the outcome of the election is going to be a big, almost a black swan type event. We don't know what that's going to do to building and the economy and growth. We'll have to wait and see.
A couple of things that are really relevant to this conversation around what is industrial development going to look like over the next couple of years is, what are interest rates? Obviously, that impacts all types of developments. But something else that I wanted to note is that land prices have been a little bit stickier in this, at least in Southern California, around this sort of adjustment in industrial real estate. You know, as we've talked about, industrial prices in the rental market have come down a lot. But a lot of people that are sitting on assets that they either paid a lot of money for or thought were worth way more than they are kind of going, wait a minute, this is a temporary thing. I don't really want to sell. I'll only sell at a high price. So even though you're seeing the rental market come down and normalize a bit, not fully, but a bit, you really haven't seen asset purchase sale prices change that much, unless there is a similar to office space, unless someone needs to sell because they're at the end of their fund life or something like that. The other thing that we're seeing is, because the amount of development under construction has fallen so much, you're actually seeing the cost to construct these buildings start to fall pretty meaningfully too. I mean, in the last year and a half, you've probably seen the cost to construct Class A industrial buildings from just a vertical construction standpoint fall into the double digit percent, which that has a really big impact in terms of your total basis in the asset. And that coupled with interest rates coming down, we may be able to have a lot of these buildings delivered at a price that is, you know, can support rental rates that are 20 or 30% lower if all of these different factors kind of hit at once. So it'll be really interesting to see. I mean, I think the willingness of developers to deliver more Class A industrial real estate is going to be very dependent on the price that they can acquire land, the rates at which they can finance, and the cost at which they can build. And if all of those are becoming more favorable, then I don't think that even in the face of a lack of demand, I don't think that we'll see the amount of pipeline for new development fall to, you know, 2009-10 levels. I really don't. But I do think that for Southern California, you know, we had a peak of 56 million square feet under construction a couple of years ago. That's now fallen to 31 million square feet of under construction today. I bet that 31 million square feet of under construction number falls into the 20s, but probably the low 20s. Obviously, as John said, there's a lot of variables that are unknowable at this point, like the outcome of the upcoming election and the outcome of a whole lot of other economic activity that's going on these days.
Yeah, I'll just add, and this is a different asset class because it's manufacturing, but I was shocked. So we're conducting a multi-market search for a client, and I'll leave it at this is in the Midwest. It's 100 to 200,000 feet of industrial manufacturing, and we're looking at existing buildings and new construction. And we just got quoted for new construction from a developer, a 7, and this is not an economic development play. There is no outside forces. This is a pure cost of capital play for the developer. A 7% return on cost as his initial proposal to build a building for us, right? So I thought that was very promising in terms of where they're willing to go based upon current debt markets to be at 7% cost of construction.
You must have fantastic credit.
No, they don't. I will tell you, it is a company with a tremendous story that lacks credit. It's a clean tech company that's new in emerging technologies. But what it tells me is that these developers have a lot of capital sitting on the sidelines waiting to be deployed, and they will deploy it towards a tenant in hand rather than spend the money spec to build a building and wait for the tenants to come. And now this building is not highly specialized. It could be reused. I think that's a big component of this, right? So you're building, 37 foot clear, effectively just a empty box that they would bring equipment into, right? So it has a high probability of reuse in the marketplace if this company was to go away. But what I view it as is that they have a lot of capital sitting on the sidelines, both debt and equity, that allows them to be very aggressive. They want to build, but they're not going to build it on spec. They're waiting for a tenant to come along, and they'll do it at a very aggressive return to do it, right, to get that building out of the ground.
Yeah, the variance in yields that different developers are looking for right now is truly insane. I've seen developers for spec buildings say, hey, we're only going to build a building if we can get a 200 basis point spread off of a stabilized cap rate of what we think we're going to exit at of 6%, in which case they're essentially building to an 8% return on cost versus what Brian's talking about for a company that doesn't sound like they have super strong credit, but a good story, that's building to 7. At the same time, you have developers that not only instead of taking a 200 basis point spread will say, hey, we'll take a 100 basis point spread, but they also may have access to lower cost of capital and might be building to something that's more like, 6.25 or 6.5. I mean, it's truly wild, the different forms of capital. And right now for these types of developments, we are seeing the large REITs be by far the most competitive. And when you look at what their, price earnings ratio is, or really if you look at like what their funds from operation relative to their price, kind of like their FFO ratio relative to price off of like next year's revenue. I mean, you see some of these really large REITs, like the Prologis's and the Rexfords and these types of groups. And then you compare their cost of capital to other people. And it's wild how much more competitive that they can be on interest rates right now than a sort of like real estate private equity firm that is managing other people's money that needs to get much higher returns. So on all of these as deals, as you know, Brian knows from finding a, I'm sure there was a lot of effort that went into, you know, finding that return on cost is 7% for that type of deal. Granted, there's big variance depending on if that's in, you know, Dallas or in Arkansas or some, you know, secondary market, or if it's in Southern California, there's, you know, widespread, but I'm sure you've seen that. And, you know, producing a 7% return on cost usually requires talking to lots of people. So that's really cool.
It was very interesting. And I tell you, the other side of this is that as a comparison, the market. So when in a conversation, I'm pausing because I'm trying to decide if I use the landlord's name, but I'm not going to. This is, you know, I've thrown enough landlords under the bus, but this is actually not a negative. It's just a data point. The one of the largest office landlords, we were in a conversation with them recently, and what they said is like, look, we have a lot of ways to deploy our capital, and we wouldn't build a building right now but for less than 15% return on cost. Like, we need a 15% return. And this is a large public REIT structure. They look at it and say, we don't want to put our capital into another office building right now. And they have a lot of different channels that they can deploy into. They'd rather keep the cash, keep the powder dry and wait for a better opportunity if they can't get at least a 15% return on a new office building. That is, you know, that is kind of shocking to me, as they are a premier office landlord that you'd think would want to get as much premier office product out of the ground as possible. But in today's climate, they're looking at it very differently, which I thought was interesting. So to your point, Tucker, asset class, obviously very different, but owner to owner and even within the REITs, very different thought process on how they deploy and where they deploy and what they deploy into.
Yeah. One other note here is just that these yields are, when you're looking at a return on cost style transaction, if you only focus on the yield, it's actually really challenging to compare transactions apples to apples. When someone is proposing a return on cost style transaction, generally it's going to be whatever the return on cost interest rate is, call it the rental constant of the transaction, multiplied by whatever the total investment or the landlord's total basis is in the property. And when you look at the variance in what people include in that total basis, there's a lot of extra figures. Is the developer charging a big development fee? What's the general contractor's profit? Are financing fees included in that number? So you start thinking about, like, okay, the, you know, if you have an interest rate multiplied by the total cost, and the total cost of one option is much higher, it's no different than having a more normalized total cost and a higher interest rate. So you really need to be looking at these things holistically of what's included in that, like, total project cost that's being multiplied by that interest rate. But for most developers today that are out there building a spec building, the way that they are calculating everything, their total basis usually factors in some assumed amount of tenant improvement capital and downtime, and then obviously their cost to construct. And at a minimum, if you're doing a build-to-suit, you should be able to capture all of those assumptions that would normally go in. So if you're doing a build-to-suit and you're not building a specialized building that is more expensive to construct than another building, you should be at least participating in the benefit of that implied downtime that the developer would have. But not only that, you should be able to participate in all of the upsides that they have by being able to access permanent debt markets sooner, de-risking the investment in general, and a host of other things. So if a developer is saying, hey, we need to get a, we're building to a 7 or 7.5% return on a spec basis, then you're probably a minimum of 50 basis points lower on a build-to-suit basis from a return standpoint. And then it's just around optimizing what's actually included in that total cost bucket.
Yeah, I think you hit a great point. the pieces of that cost bucket that I've seen that just got, you know, that raise a lot of eyebrows is around the contractor's profit and then general conditions. If you rush through a process, and I say this for our clients that think that you can push through a process and not have mechanisms in a contract to be able to control these variables, contractors will come through with massive general condition budgets. And their profits will be oversized because of the speed at which and the risk that you're asking them to take in terms of their pricing. So you just have to be careful and look at obviously development fees and development profits and all these other layers of fees, the management fees. Like developers will have a development profit, then a management fee to manage the project. Well, isn't your management fee part of your profit, right? And in a lot of cases, they're going to want to break those two fees out. So there's a lot of value in really digging in and understanding, you know, how long they're going to carry the debt for, right? Because there's going to be some sort of financing cost in the deal. And the length of time, their rates, the quality of that note flows back through the P&L to you or through the budget to you. So being able to understand, are they getting, because at the end of the day, it's your cost. So are they getting the best rates? Are they doing the best terms? Or are they rewarding a friend that has helped them on a spec building or helped them in the past? And they're providing them some sort of a premium in order to make it up on the next building where they are at risk, right? So there's a lot of value in digging in and having a team that can really understand these and compare them one to market, but also compare them to what's just reasonable. In terms of how the deal is structured and what the costs are and what the returns are for the developer.
So I've got a question for you, Tucker. Do you have those numbers? And are you suggesting that, I know that sometimes you can look at a REIT and measure their price to FFO ratio, but that's really not equivalent to a cap rate. Maybe we can compare them to each other in that way. But to get a cap rate, we've got to, you know, to price to their NOI. If you do like Prologis price to FFO is something like 26, which is, you know, would be a crazy cap rate. So, I mean, I wondered, is this a way to measure REIT performance? And if so, is it just within the REIT sphere? I've never really contemplated price to FFO.
If you look at price based off of FFO of next year, so like 2025 FFO relative to price, and you compute a ratio based off of that price, and then you compare all of the different REITs FFO ratios across one another, you will find a almost perfect correlation to who has the least expensive capital for build-to-suit transactions. But you're correct, John. Prologis is not saying, hey, we're building to, if their 2025 FFO ratio is a, you know, implies a 4.5% or 5% cap rate. That's not where they're actually doing transactions. Although there may be points in time where it is, you know, even a, you know, broken clock is wrong, you know, twice a day type of deal, where if interest rates were extremely low and then they moved higher, right? Or if they were really high and then they moved lower, you may see periods where like it does perfectly line up, but it's just circumstance.
It's not often that I could correct you, Tucker, but in fact, a broken clock is correct twice a day. You said wrong twice.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, something with clocks. That's all I was trying to say there. Or as someone in Canada recently told me, even a blind squirrel occasionally finds nuts. And I really liked that one. It felt very Canadian to me.
You ready for me to talk about dual agency?
Yeah, please.
I know Brian hates this story for a number of reasons. But the reason I'm bringing it up has to do with dual agency. And listeners to the pod would probably already know this about us, that we're pretty focused on a dual agency is a bad thing. In fact, we've changed the law in the state of California for at least disclosing it. And dual agency is where the same broker is representing both sides to a transaction, a landlord and a tenant, a buyer and a seller. It's not allowed for attorneys. It's not allowed for CPAs. There's all sorts of disclosure how do you make the price go up and down? You just can't, and all the other subtle details of negotiation. So we're not a fan of dual agency. I'm also quick to point out the folks that do it aren't bad people, right? I mean, there's some fantastic brokers. Some of my dearest friends are at these full service commercial real estate firms and representing tenants, and I'm sure they do a fine job. But we're just suggesting that, broadly speaking, it would be better if everybody had to pick a side and kind of get out of that murky, muddy middle. And so here's an example. And yes, it's a otherwise kind of an ugly story. From the Palm Beach Post, a former owner of Jeff Bezos' second Florida home sues real estate company over the sale. Here's why. Just a little bit of background detail. In August 2023, Bezos reportedly bought a waterfront estate in billionaire bunker for $68 million. Big, big numbers. A few months later, in October 2023, Bezos bought his second home in the neighborhood for $79 million. And the owner who originally listed the home for $85 million is now suing the brokers that made that deal. That brokerage firm was Douglas Elliman. And their complaint states the seller of the home is suing Douglas Elliman, which handled both sides of the transaction, saying the company misled him about the identity of the buyer, which cost him $6 million in the process. According to the complaint, the seller was a Brazilian toy and electronics company co-founder Leo Chris. He actually asked the brokerage company if Bezos was the buyer. And the CEO of the brokerage firm, not the agents representing the seller or the agents representing the buyer, but the CEO of the regional office of Douglas Elliman spoke up. And he called Chris, the seller, to tell him that it wasn't Bezos and the buyer wouldn't pay more than $79 million, leading him to sell, accept it. He took the $79 million. After the deal closed, the CEO, who had told Chris that the buyer wasn't Bezos, then he emailed Chris to confirm that he actually really didn't know, but he thought that the buyer was the family of this Benny Klepek, the mayor of Indian Creek Village, who runs duty-free shops and airports across the Americas. And then in attorney speak, they say, despite Parker's representations regarding Mr. Klepek, and given the duties that were owed by the broker, Parker's position as the CEO and president of the broker, and his 24 years as a lawyer, Parker knew or should have known that the presumed deal did not involve Mr. Klepek's family, but instead Bezos. And so enough about multi-million dollar Florida transactions, but just this idea that why put yourself in that position as a brokerage firm when you're representing both sides to a transaction? Clearly, I think the seller, you know, he doesn't need another $7 million, I suppose, but I think he's right. I think they should have known, and they certainly shouldn't have said otherwise if they didn't know. I guess I'd be mad if I was the seller.
I think it's much trickier in residential real estate than it is in commercial, because no one that is good in residential does only buyer representation. Or I should say, basically no one that is good does that. Maybe there's one or two people that I'm not familiar with, but all of residential real estate is around controlling listings and not controlling buyers, because people don't always buy, right? And if you start working with someone, say you're, you know, wanting to buy a huge house in Miami or something, and you're, you know, working with a buyer, or you're going to sell your home, the person that you engage, there's no way to know whether you're going to be a recipient of dual agency. And if you're picked between like working with someone that's competent or having dual agency, or potentially having risks of dual agency risks, I think most people would probably choose to work with someone who is competent and has experience with these, you know, mid eight figure type of transactions. The key distinction is in that commercial real estate, the vast majority of people that are best at representing companies doing occupier representation actually only represent occupiers, because the conflicts are really dark, and there's a means to making money as a, you know, doing only occupier representation. Whereas if you only do buyer representation in residential, you're just, it doesn't work. People figure out who you are by representing really big listings that sell, right? Like, that's generally how that industry works. Whereas in commercial real estate, if you're trying to hire a broker to help your company that does occupier representation, most of the time you're probably going to call your friend at another big company and say, hey, who did you use? And that's how occupier representation brokers generally get hired for really large projects. So yeah, bummer. I think that if your client asks you something directly, that you have a fiduciary responsibility to answer honestly, and that you should know if Jeff Bezos is the buyer or not. Or if you don't know, you should be able to say, I don't think it is, here's why, it could be, here's why. That didn't happen. I think that's a problem, but I know Brian's going to say that he doesn't like people suing other people, which I generally agree with too. But the good news is that in commercial real estate, you really don't have to even consider this. You can just work with someone that has no conflicts, that will have no conflicts, that never represents landlords on your transaction or others. So you know that there's not going to be a problem. And that's what we see more and more of the, you know, leading companies with this most sophisticated real estate teams doing.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to unpack here. And I do hate the litigious nature of the United States markets. It's challenging in a lot of ways. But it's not the reason I said I hated this. I hate this because at the core of it, if people are just good people, they have ethics and they're willing and they put their egos aside and say, I don't know, but this is what I think, he wouldn't have been in this position. My gut is that he was overconfident that he had the best information. He knew the answer and he didn't say it was my opinion, not a fact. Right. And that's a problem. If you don't have the answer, you have to say it. And I think the best people in business, at least the ones that I've studied and I've met and I've read about, first and foremost, they're ethical and they're honest. And that's at the core of this. That's why I hate it, because somebody let their greed or let their ego get in the way of being honest. Tucker, I think your point is right around our industry to a point. And I don't know if it's 50% of the market or it could be 30% of the market, but there's a massive amount of the market where the large real estate firms represent tenants and they represent them on a portfolio basis. Think about some of the largest users in the world. They are likely under master service agreements with the large firms. Those large firms have the vast majority of listings across every market. So if you're a large user and your team tells you that they only represent tenants, okay, but then your firm, it could be the largest, second largest, the third largest firm in the world that represents owners. And when you have those single source portfolio accounts, you go into a market and majority of the listings you're looking at, even in your renewal, could be listed by your firm. And you may never know about it. The good brokers and the good teams will always disclose. The good clients will ask as part of a process when you start a project or when you're discussing a location to tell you exactly who the listing agents are. But having sat inside those companies for many years, it's not the case. And there is a massive amount because they are separate. But at the end of the day, those account teams rely on the markets to deliver projects for them, and they partner with their local brokers. Those local brokers are under tremendous pressure to deliver for the landlords in those markets and for the other clients of that market. And I'll give you an example, and I won't tell you the firm, but in their deck to the major office landlords in the city of Boston, there is a slide. And on the slide, it has lists a dozen projects and what those dozen, and there's some of the biggest projects in the city. Those are the projects they had both sides of the deal. And the message on that slide that they tell their audience is, we represent some of the biggest users in this market and we will deliver them to your buildings. And they try to get hired, and they do get hired by these landlords because they can deliver their clients to their buildings, right? And tell me that's right. Right? Nobody can ever tell me that is ethical, that's honest, or that's right. And that is the crux of it. You can't get away from it. And I know I've been in conversations, my team, and I feel for the big users and I feel for companies that work with these companies because they trust the people they work with. And the people they work with could be the greatest people in the world, but they rely on their local brokers in the market. And those local brokers report to a managing director in that market. And their job is to drive business, and those landlords drive more business than the one deal that large user does. It's just a fact of life. And there's so much pressure at that level to deliver the deal to their clients. And it's so much so they put it on a slide and tell the owners, if you hire us, we'll put our clients in your buildings and we'll do it at a premium to the market.
I love your story, Tucker. We won't name names, but I've heard you tell it about, running a not insignificant transaction in Manhattan. And because the local brokerage community couldn't pick up the phone and figure out what was going on, and it drove them crazy. you know, by not being in the fraternity, I think it counters everything Brian was just describing in terms of controlling and delivering for the building ownership.
I just had a scenario where you're talking about dual representation. How about like, I don't know, triple representation? So we've been asked by a client to get involved. Their previous provider represented the tenant, represented the owner, and we also had the portfolio up for sale. So they had it from every different direction, and they're like, yeah, we wanted you to take a look at this. And it's like, probably a good idea. Yeah, you should probably bring us in on this project. So it was a good way to win business. It's a good way to get involved. It's a good way for clients to, you know, keep honest people honest. And sometimes it's, you know, it's not people doing the wrong thing. It's the machine or the system that's pushing or creating the, you know, the problem. And as my, you know, I think my grandfather used to tell me that locks are not to keep thieves from stealing your stuff. It's to keep honest people from stealing your stuff. And sometimes a little bit of separation does that too, to keep people honest.
But you may bring up such a key important point, and it's super subtle. So maybe it's lost on some folks, but like when I got in this business, the home run was to sell the developer the land, do the marketing of that project for lease, help them to get it leased up, and then sell it off as a leased investment. And then go do it again. Take the profits from that successful development, buy some more land, build another building, lease it up, and sell it off. But when you're playing that game, you know, that investment sale, the third leg of that stool, becomes crucial. And of course, the rent that the tenants are paying are what drive the value of that investment sale. So the minute you're playing the wealth accumulation, rising rents, profit, you know, we're going to sell this building. Once we have a focus on selling the building at the end, you can't represent the occupier. I mean, you're future focused on building value. And so the folks that maybe they don't represent landlord and tenant, but if you're selling leased investments, you're selling our clients that are paying the rent, you're selling their rent stream at some cap rate. If you're focused on that, you're not delivering the best outcome for the occupier. It can't be.
Yeah, I used to use it as a, and I've never represented owners. I never will. Even when I was within a shop that did, I used to use it as kind of like a badge of honor when the managing partner or the managing director of that office would come into my office. And it used to happen way too much, for their sake, and tell me that I was pushing too hard on a landlord and they're a big client of the firm and I really need to back off. And I used to get in, you guys would be surprised about this, but I used to get in some pretty heated shouting matches with owners about it, or my, you know, leaders of my office. So much so, you know, they put me on the opposite side of the office and they didn't want me mentoring young people. And I was an outcast personally. And I used it as a badge of honor because I only do one thing and I've always only done one thing. And you know what? It's, if that's what it takes, for me to, you know, do the best I can for my clients, then so be it. It was always done professionally and ethically and the right way, but I didn't play ball with, you know, everyone playing nice in the sandbox. I only represented my clients, and I hate to, you know, talk about myself in this situation, but having lived it for 20 years, like what we talk about is real. It's not fear mongering. It's not, you know, it's not a one-off situation. It is day in and day out at the shops, and their goal is volume. Their goal is to create a machine that makes it impossible to work with other people because they control everything and all the information. And what that does is allow everybody to, you know, it allows all the tenants to pay more, than they should. And firms like ours and others in the industry are the disruptors that bring balance. And I think it continues to, just like the, you know, the other industries that have adopted a much more open and honest platform, the more information that gets out there, the more technology comes into play, the more balanced it will become, because information is power here. And it's been a fun ride over the last 20 years because it's come a long way and there's a lot of room to continue to grow.
Well, let's change gears. I got something else to talk about. And it's about life science real estate. And so since our last pod, you know, the dam that's been, you know, breaking over the past year and definitely, you know, has broken already so far this last quarter is with life science real estate. And finally, it's been reported publicly on the wire. There was an article, I think, on Labor Day, in fact, in the Wall Street Journal about this. And it's what was going on during the pandemic that's driven us to where we are today. And, you know, I would like to equate it to the famous quote by Gordon Gekko in the movie Wall Street, "Greed is good." It drove a wave of overdevelopment in the life science market during the pandemic when nobody was going to the office, but, you know, people can't practice science from their kitchen table. So there was a surging demand for life science product, not to mention everyone was racing to find vaccines and so forth for COVID-19. And everyone tried to cash in on this high demand. Well, guess what happens when people get greedy? You know, someone's left holding the short end of the stick and usually unsuccessful in whatever their endeavor was, which was trying to capture the demand. And so with the venture lending to be kind of drying up, or at least been pretty quiet this year, interest rates at all-time highs relative to the past 5 years, demand for these properties have really tapered off and left some people with questions like, what do we do now? And so it's been reported that in Boston, Brian, your market, owners for at least 10 life science buildings, once office buildings, now life science buildings, are now reversing course. And guess what? They're offering those spaces for lease to be office space instead of life science at what is a 30% discount to what they were trying to achieve. So think during the pandemic, or, you know, even this past year, trying to achieve $100 rents, they're now saying we'll take $70 for office space. And I don't even think that's going to get it done. And just to give everyone, our listeners, a sense of enormity, okay? Like, okay, like my, as I was reading this article, and as someone that might be trying to figure out what this all means and put it into context in terms of size and scope, before the pandemic, we were adding approximately 3.7 million square feet of life science real estate to the market, okay? That was kind of average. Since the first quarter of 2020, we added over 59 million square feet of new product. And even now, there's still 19.1 million square feet of development in process at varying stages. And you can assume that some of that stuff might just be curtailed or just kind of put on the sideline until there's a demand. But this is kind of what happens when people overbuild. And I think it's for those listeners that have, you know, any type of space, specifically life science, is a good thing, right? It's not so good for the life science owners, but, you know, with the surge of supply and the dropping demand, that's just economics 101. The prices are going to fall, and it's going to force oversaturated markets to capitulate, and you'll see lower rents. And, you know, the good news is that it provides companies lots of options at discounted prices. It does put a lot of strain on the market, which, you know, is tough for those trying to deliver high quality space. And I think it's unfortunate for the institutional life science owners who have been building quality product for decades upon decades that are going to end up suffering from those that were not life science developers, never were, and tried to moonlight as some as such during the pandemic by converting buildings that perceivably had absolutely no demand for office space in terms of life science, and now they're trying to reverse course. So it's nobody's immune to what's going on in the world, and this just provides our clients more opportunity.
Yeah, but the math doesn't work. Like, how? So I'll give you an example in San Diego. In Boston, in your market as well, Brian, IQHQ is a group that just proceeded with their development, their spec developments, right? And there was a time, I mean, I wrote an article during the pandemic, Life Science to the Rescue, right? The industry surged, money was running into it, it was a solution to the office problem. Everyone is converting office buildings to lab space. But for example, IQHQ proceeding in downtown San Diego, not a life science market, with a $1.6 billion development called RAD, R-A-A-D, 1.7 million square feet delivered to the market. And don't get me wrong, it's beautiful space, world-class, oceanfront. It just happens to be in an untested life science market, and I'm not sure who's going to... They haven't signed a single life science lease. It's up, it's done, it's out of the ground. What's going to happen? So, you know, they need $6 and $7 monthly net rents to rationalize the investment in the warm shells and the TIs that are going to be needed. Okay, you're going to pivot to office space. That office market is in the $2 to $3, maybe $4, you know, gross, full service gross range. You can't do that. The math on office doesn't work. And it's a 25% availability rate or higher. Like, that's a languishing market. You can't pivot to, how do you pivot to office? You said they're at a 30% discount. They got to be at an 80% discount.
So it works. It works for very few cases. It works for corporate headquarter, large users that are looking at brand new construction, right? Because and take IQHQ out of the picture. We'll talk about them separately. But what if it's well capitalized, what they're doing, and they haven't put the full investment in, right? They can bring the basis down because they haven't fully invested in the lab build. They haven't brought all the lab infrastructure in. The lab TIs are much higher. So you could effectively buy down the net rent for the office user. Right. So if you come into it and you're paying, and say it's a $6 rent in California, $6 per square foot per month, and you get a $250 or $350 square foot TI allowance, you're buying down the effective rent with 18 months, you know, 12 months, 18 months, 24 months of free rent. So you could make the deals pencil out, but it has to be tenants that are only looking for that, what we talked in previous episodes, that top 5%, 6%, 2%, as you had predicted it, because there's not a lot of brand new office products sitting on the sidelines waiting to be leased. There was not a lot of office spec development. So if a company is looking at it from the perspective, I can go lease a former lab building that's in a location that's high quality, in some cases they are, or I can go build a new office building, the numbers actually work out really well. And they're actually more favorable to go do the deal in the lab building. And we're looking at a headquarters for a client right now, and 75% of the options are lab buildings. So it works, but it doesn't work for your average, you know, 10, 20, 30, half a floor, full floor user, unless there's already an anchor that has leased, you know, 80% of the project. What it works for is those large users that are looking for the highest and best, the premier space in a market, and some of these lab buildings can deliver that. The IQHQ story is very different. I think our clients should be very careful. They have a product in San Diego, in Silicon Valley, and here in Boston that's not well located. Their lender, the Bank of the Ozarks, is concerning. I would say leave it at that in terms of their risk profile, and the projects are not leasing. So I think there's going to be, and they're in the market trying to raise more money. And I don't know if that was successful. I don't think it was. I have not heard that it was. So it'll be interesting to see how that turns out. But there's going to be a certain piece of the market that, like IQHQ or others, where you see some of the larger life science REITs kind of come in and probably acquire those assets at some point for, you know, some percentage of total project cost.
Yeah. And I think it's also going to be, the winners are going to be those that are, you know, not only delivering quality product versus some class B commodity building that they tried to convert and are suggesting to the market that it's life science, but when you compare it to institutional grade space, it's just not. But also location is going to be a huge part, right? Like IQHQ, for those of you guys that, you know, in Brian's market, they're building a massive million square foot development on the doorstep of Fenway Park. I mean, they show renderings of their facility, you know, with people practicing lab work, looking out over the ball game. I mean, literally, it's a phenomenal project, but I can only imagine how much that thing's costing, because it's built over the turnpike, if I recall, Brian. You would know better than I, but... yeah, it's a remarkable project. If they can pull it off, it delivers next year. At least that's what it's supposed to do. But I don't believe they've had any leasing yet, much like your project there in San Diego, John.
Yeah, there is no leasing. And if I was a betting man, which I'm not, I would tell you that building will trade. It is in a core life science market. That's the outskirts of the Longwood Medical area, which is all our meds and eds kind of area, right? Harvard Medical School to all the hospitals. And that bled historically into the Fenway. And then as Cambridge and the Seaport filled up, the Fenway became a very strong life science market with the hospitals and education. So it's a core market. And I think if I was to be a betting man, the core life science developers that are well capitalized would love to get their hands on that development someday. And if it doesn't lease, I wouldn't be surprised if that is something they use to monetize, even vacant, because it's such a core, just a phenomenal building in a phenomenal location. I will go back to your point. I don't know who made it, but these, the bread and butter life science developers, the AREs of the world, like someone said that it kind of felt bad for them. I will tell you that what my hope is in this whole down cycle, and it is a massive down cycle in terms of the demand for life science. There's in Boston right now, I saw a report that there's about 1.5 million square feet of life science demand on the market. I tell you, 50% of that is not real. And 2 years ago, that was 8 million feet, which was like 5 million of real demand, 6 million of real demand. So we're talking under 1 million square feet 2 years ago was 5x that, maybe 10x that, depends who you talk to. So it's a real bloodbath out there in terms of the demand side. But the life science, remember, life science developers charge their tenants the same rent on the office space as they do on the lab space. And that's the game that they play, right? So you go into these buildings and it could be ARE or anyone, you're paying the same amount for the office. And my hope is that there's a way to start to bifurcate those. And you put different rents on the different portions of the occupancy, or tenants are able to start, especially larger ones that are looking at campuses, are starting to build and look at it differently. We're going to have our labs in one building half the building and office on the other. And I will tell you that some developers are doing this. So Trammell Crow has a project in the burbs where half the building's lab and half the building's office, and it's priced differently. So there's, I think the market hopefully will come around where you can start to create more value for your clients, in the sense that let's look at these operations and let's look at the needs separately.
Well said, Brian. Okay, let's wrap up there. That's episode 44 of the Corporate Real Estate Insider Podcast. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll be back with the next episode soon.